Welcome to Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today we're going to be talking about the Liberal Democrats. There are many parties that can claim to be the story of this Parliament. UKIP, of course, having won the European elections and have their first two members of Parliament elected in Douglas Carswell and Mark Reckless. The SNP, who have seemingly bounced back from defeat to potential victory from the Scottish referendum last autumn to now looking like they might achieve as many as 30 to 50 seats, depending on who you read at the general election. But what about the Liberal Democrats? Surely they are as much the story of this Parliament as anybody else. They've obviously been in government properly for the first time in many generations, for the first time indeed in their current existence, depending on how you want to interpret their history. But perhaps they're in the headlines too for a lot of the wrong reasons. Their vote share has collapsed, and in the case of Danny Alexander and Nick Clegg, they may very well be fighting for their very existence in Parliament. But are things as bad as they sound? The Liberal Democrats will obviously be hoping that the general election is their national version of that Eastleigh by-election, where actually the Liberal Democrats do much, much better, where they already have an established presence. Lots to talk about, and I'm pleased to be joined today by Liberal Democrat commentator and public relations expert Mark Pack, who also runs the Liberal Democrat Newswire. Mark, welcome very much to Polling Matters.
Hello, and thank you very much for inviting me on.
So, Mark, let's start at the beginning. Lots to cover, as I've said. I mean, obviously, the Liberal Democrats, in terms of their national vote share, are doing very poorly. I mean, what do we attribute that to? I mean, Tony Blair, in his usual way of being quite concise and cutting, has said that, frankly, the Liberal Democrats stood on a platform to the left of Labour. Now they're in a government that's on a platform to the right of Labour, and they're being punished for it. Do you see it as that straightforward? I mean, what do you think?
I don't fully agree with Tony Blair, but I think he does have a point in that if you look at the party's poll ratings, they started falling really straight after the last general election. And therefore, it was the principle of going into coalition and not what the party was doing in coalition that caused the poll ratings to drop. Because almost from day one, the poll ratings were dropping and there wasn't yet a chance to see actually what the party was doing in coalition. The one thing that voters knew at that time was, oh, they've gone into coalition. So that is the underlying problem the party has faced, and I think it would have faced that just as much if it had gone into coalition with Labour, because if you look at the polling that was done in the run-up to the 2010 election or immediately afterwards asking Lib Dem voters what their preferred outcome was, there was a huge chunk who said the preferred outcome was a Lib Dem-Tory deal, but also a huge chunk who said their preferred outcome was a Lib Dem-Labour deal. And therefore, whichever way the party would have gone, it would have lost a large chunk of support by the very nature of having to make a choice.
That's interesting, because one of the sort of conventional wisdoms about the Liberal Democrats is that their members and candidates and people like that are overwhelmingly much more in favour of deals with the Labour Party rather than the Conservative Party. So do you see that had there been a Lab-Lib coalition that the negative impact on the Liberal Democrats' poll ratings would have been just as bad? Do you think it would have been less bad? I mean, where do you see that?
I think it would have been of the same order of magnitude. And maybe that's best illustrated by issues around civil liberties, which is an important issue for very many Liberal Democrat activists and members and a moderate chunk of voters, although it's obviously not number one issue. But imagine if Liberal Democrats had gone into coalition with Labour, there'd have been a whole group of centre-left people who would have said, hang on a minute, you're opposed to ID cards, you're opposed to 14, 21, 90, all of that escalation, number of days detention without trial for terrorist suspects, etc. You're opposed to Labour on all of these things, and now you've gone into coalition with them. So there would have been a huge number of things where even people on the centre-left would have been really angry at the idea of Liberal Democrats being in coalition with Labour. Obviously, as it was, with Liberal Democrats in coalition with Tories, there was a different set of issues that people have been really angry with. But it was a bit of a sort of frying pan and fire choice. With the one crucial exception that, obviously being in politics in part is about ratings in opinion polls, how many seats you have, popularity. But the other part of politics is about getting your policies implemented. And if you look at the number of Liberal Democrat policies that have turned into actual government implementation, there's been far more of those in the last 5 years than in the rest of the party's history put together.
But then perhaps Liberal Democrats not getting credit amongst the public, would you say, for that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's partly because, for reasons that are quite understandable, but in a way are so successful it's easy to forget, the party's immediate message after going into coalition was about saying this is a united government that's working together successfully, etc., and therefore sounding almost like we were liking the fact that we're in government with the Tories. Now that came with a political cost, but the reason for doing that was that prior to the 2010 election, the working assumption amongst the sort of political punditry circles, the sort of political bubble, was that hung parliament equals instability equals disaster. And we'd seen that in several previous general elections where it looked like there might be a hung parliament. And as polling day got closer, all of these fear stories were hugely stoked up and support flowed back to the two main parties as a result. Liberal Democrats got squeezed. So the approach the party took after the May 2010 election certainly came with a political cost, but it also actually helped slay that myth. And it so successfully slayed that myth that I think people have forgotten just how dangerous and powerful and potent a myth it was and just how damaging it was to parties other than the main two parties in the run-up to previous general elections. And now, you know, the news is all full of all sorts, you know, there'll be a hung parliament, what are the combinations, how will the SNP act, how will UKIP act, how will the Greens act, how will the DUP act, a massive sort of cornucopia of options. And it's not scaring the public off hung parliaments at all. You've not got political commentators saying this is going to be a disaster. You've not got business leaders saying, oh, this will be a, you know, appalling for the economy. People have got really used to a hung parliament. And that, as it were, is the upside of that decision made in May 2010. So there is an upside to it. Sadly, it may be an upside that
for someone else.
Parties like UKIP and the SNP gain four more in the end. But, yeah. You know, in the overall interest of British politics, one can obviously say it's a good thing.
So let's look at where the Liberal Democrats are. I mean, I guess it's fair to say if we look at, I'm looking at some of the recent numbers from, we've got Comrades here, Lib Dems on 7 or 8, depending on which Comrades poll you look at. ICM is at 8 today, previously have been much higher. But it seems to be that the Liberal Democrat poll rating is anywhere between sort of 5 and 10 points. I'm going to assume that you're going to be saying that actually the real poll rating is towards the higher end of that. But what do we attribute those differences down to, and where do you see the kind of real figure, or don't we know?
Some of them are just simply the random variation that you get between different polls. And so I maintain this spreadsheet, which tries to be this record of all of the national voting intention opinion polls, the most sort of comprehensive set that there is there. And it has been a real burden maintaining it during this parliament, because there have been more public opinion polls in this parliament than in the last three parliaments put together. And we've not even yet got to the end of the parliament, so heaven knows how many we will have by the end of it. And that huge volume of polls also means that there are more polls that are outliers that get published. The upside is it's easier to spot the outlier. The downside is you do every now and again get a poll that is way out one way or another for one party or another. And yeah, as we speak on today, there's an Ashcroft poll that shows the Liberal Democrats up 3 points. I don't think that's the start of a Liberal Democrat surge. It more reflects that the previous Ashcroft poll, the one that put the party on 5% you referred to, was very much an outlier. And now that, back up to 8%, which is more where that sort of 7, 8, 9% where the centre of gravity of the polling seems to be.
I mean, one of the things that is often talked about by the commentators is, swing back or reversion to the mean and things. Obviously, these are phenomena that we've seen in past elections, traditionally with the Conservatives being the main beneficiary. One of the things that a lot of people have expected is there to be a swing back to the Liberal Democrats as we get closer to polling day. And so far, that doesn't seem to be happening. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. Would they be right to hope for that?
I think there's a big difference between what's happening in the sort of seats that the party's fighting really intensively and the rest of the country. And that classically what would happen is the Liberal Democrats will get very little public attention for most of the parliament, and then they'd get more attention as the general election neared. And that would therefore partly explain that swing back effect, as would also the ramping up of the party's grassroots operation in key seats.
And then I suppose as there's more and more parties involved, it feels like at the moment with UKIP and the Greens, and the SNP in Scotland, then that's much more difficult for the Liberal Democrats.
Absolutely. And also the party has been much more in the news all through the parliament. So I think that general swing back effect, it's not surprising it's much more muted this time. But everything I sort of hear and see from the key seats suggests that actually that swing back effect in the key seats is happening, and it's happening on a significant scale. And you see it with the two internal constituency polls that the party has released, one in for Lynn Featherston's seat in Hornsey and Wood Green, one for Bob Smith's seat up in Scotland, West Aberdeenshire. And in both cases, they show the Liberal Democrats in with a very real chance of winning the seat, which is different from, for example, the Ashcroft polling previously in those seats. Now, I think that's partly down to naming the candidates in the constituency polling, but it's also, actually, I think, because of that swing back effect.
Well, but although I'll challenge you on that point, because one of the things with the Lynn Featherstone poll was that there were, I believe there were sort of favourite, I think it was favourability, but there was some kind of approval rating asked before the voting intention question. And I suppose, yeah, this has obviously caused a lot of people to sort of dismiss these polls and say, look, you know, it's comfort polling, as Lord Ashcroft says, you know, the questions are leading. I mean, are you arguing that actually, almost using that methodology, is presenting the decision in the way that the voter in that constituency will make it, because, you know, it is about those candidates?
Absolutely. And let me turn the question round. Supposing a political party was to release polling in a constituency that didn't name the candidates, and Lord Ashcroft's polling had always named the candidates, who on earth would give any credence to the idea that choosing between those two methodologies, not naming the candidates when there are candidate names on the ballot paper when people actually cast their votes, is the right thing to do? You know, there is this massive and really almost quite absurd assumption with the Ashcroft polling that not naming the candidates is the right thing to do. And what basis is there for that? 50 years ago, sure, when, you know, MPs' personal votes were far, far smaller, were, you know, tiny, often maybe a few hundred votes, it would have made sense. But, you know, we're not living 50 years ago. It is really quite remarkable how this assumption that we should pay attention to constituency polling that doesn't name the candidates has become so widespread amongst people who, you know, like to think of themselves as being really sort of knowledgeable and cynical and sceptical and they're poring over the details. And the basic question you should ask every time you look at Ashcroft poll is, or indeed, you know, the other constituency polling that happens on a, you know, less frequent scale, but, you know, sometimes also appears, where if it doesn't name the candidate, why do you think that's a sensible way of doing it? And to my mind, the answer is it clearly isn't.
But there's a difference between naming the candidate in the voting intention question and then actually asking some kind of approval or favourability separate question before you actually do the voting intention, isn't there? Because it feels a little bit like to me that it's saying, okay, do you think Lynn Featherstone's doing a good job? And then you're primed in that way to then think, okay, well, actually, if I think she's doing a good job, then I might...
Well, remember that the candidate approval question asked that about both Lynn Featherstone and her Labour opponent. So it's not that only one of them was asked about. And undoubtedly, you know, if you only were to ask about one person, that would be a fair point to make. But given that in the end, people, when they see the ballot paper, you know, the candidate name is not only there, it's bigger than the party name and so on, that given that in the end you have that choice where you're picking between names, unlike, for example, the European elections, where although all the names are listed, the names are relatively obscure on the ballot paper, given that choice, you know, I think certainly the Liberal Democrat experience with constituency polling is that this is a much better way of capturing how people are going to end up behaving. Now, obviously, we will, in a way, have some good evidence of...
Well, we'll see soon enough, won't we, of
course. Enough. Clearly, you know, public opinion may move in any of the seats, so it won't be an absolute test, but we will have that. But I would come back to this question, you know, if why would people think it's sensible not to name candidates in a constituency poll? And that's a question that seems to be almost nobody asks. The other thing I would add, and again, I think this goes back to the risk of, because there are, you know, great bloggers like Mike Smith and Andy Wells who sort of pull through methodology in detail, there's a risk of sort of people thinking they're much more knowledgeable about methodology than maybe necessarily they always are. Because one of the things that I've not come across anyone mentioning, but to me is the obvious thing to mention, is, well, Gallup's methodology. You know, Gallup, highly reputable pollster. They were probably the gold standard pollster for years and
years
and years
in Britain. Gold standard.
And, you know, what did Gallup do for years and years? Gallup asked people's opinions of political party leaders before asking the voting intention question. So this idea that you ask about the personality before you ask about the voting intention question is not some, you know, weird offbeat Liberal Democrat methodology. It was actually the core methodology of one of the country's, you know, leading pollsters for years and years. Now, you might debate about, well, was their methodology right versus was someone else's right, but I would caution against placing too much credence on anyone who discusses those issues without mentioning Gallup at some point, because really, if you're serious about understanding methodology and the evidence, you can't discuss it without mentioning Gallup.
Yeah. There's obviously a lot written on that very subject, so we'll move on. But it sounds like your position that's the accurate way of actually getting to this almost incumbency bonus, which is something that it's talked, and we'll move on to talk about that now. Something that obviously is regularly talked about, the idea that if you have a personal sort of, I don't know, brand or what, if you like, in that constituency, that you'll outpoll what the party is polling. Yeah. nationally. Let's explore that, because obviously I think somebody called Fact of the Day on Twitter has tweeted in and said, you know, what do we think about the difference between the incumbency effect of Lib Dems in conservative marginals versus Labour marginals? I must confess, I'm not an expert on the Labour marginals, but it does seem that the Liberal Democrats do have something of an incumbency bonus in those seats where they're fighting against the Conservatives. I think it was the May 2015 website, obviously, of the New Statesman, have produced some analysis looking at this from Ashcroft polling that says, actually, when you just do that straight voting intention question, the Lib Dems lose virtually all of their seats to the Conservatives, where those two are fighting. But actually, when you either name the candidates, I think it is, or, you know, you do that second stage of the voting intention question, that the Liberal Democrats hold on a bit more. I mean, what's your impression of this potential incumbency bonus against the Conservatives and against Labour?
I mean, I think if you look at that two-stage voting question from Ashcroft, for example, there is a significant uptake for Liberal Democrats, both actually facing Tories and facing Labour. However, I would expect, you know, when all the votes are finally in and we're able to pore over the actual election results, we'll probably see that the incumbency boost is bigger in Tory-facing seats than in Labour-facing seats, simply because Liberal Democrats and Tories are both in coalition together. And therefore, there is an extent to which, you know, if you like the government, if you don't like the government, well, that doesn't help you choose between Liberal Democrats and Tories. So there's greater scope for saying, well, look, you might hate both of us, or you might like both of our parties, you might hate both of our parties, but actually, I'm the nicer, better, harder working person, therefore vote for me. I think it seems logical that incumbency will therefore be a bigger factor in Lib Dem Tory battles than it will be in Lib Dem Labour battles, where the incumbency boost in part has to overcome what may be otherwise Labour supporters' views of the government. And I think that can be done, and, you know, the Ashcroft polling and indeed, you know, Liberal Democrat, the released Liberal Democrat constituency polling shows that, but it's a harder sell in those seats.
But another way of looking at that, I guess, is if you take that, again, that Tony Blair analysis, which is that ultimately there's a large chunk of people that voted Liberal Democrat in 2010 because, frankly, they wanted something to the left of Labour, or they wanted something sort of centre-left, and then now they associate Nick Clegg and the Liberal Democrats with the coalition. I mean, could it not also be that actually there's that cohort of people in the Lib Dem Conservative marginals that say, well, OK, might not be happy with the Liberal Democrats in coalition, but it's either them or the Conservatives here, so I'm going to stick with them, whereas in the Liberal Democrat Labour marginals, actually, I'm going to punish the Liberal Democrats for, you know, betraying, in inverted commas, the principles to go into coalition with the Tories. That could be another way of looking at it.
If you're looking for the more left-wing of Liberal Democrat and Labour to vote for, I mean, it's not exactly a done deal as to which of the two parties is the most left-wing. Again, in the news today is that Labour have decided they're not going to provide the NHS with the extra £8 billion a year by 2020 that the NHS, Chief Executive of NHS England, says he needs. The Liberal Democrats have said, we will provide the NHS with that extra £8 billion. So Labour is going to go into the election promising to put less money into the NHS than the Liberal Democrats. Labour will go into the election with a more hardline policy on immigration than Liberal Democrats. Labour will go into the election with a more hardline policy on welfare. You look at some of Rachel Reeves's rhetoric about welfare, that is very much to the right of the Liberal Democrats. So on welfare, on immigration, on the NHS, on civil liberties, Labour is to the right of the Liberal Democrats. So a bit like, you know, we could have these fun arguments in the 2001 and 2005 elections, particularly as to which of the two parties is the most left-wing. I think it's a very open question as to which, you know, when, for example, all of the manifestos are published and you sort of pore over them, and the various political scientists always mark them up as which, you know, how left-right are the manifestos. I think it's a very open question which will turn out to be the more left-wing.
And I suppose this comes back to the central problem that maybe Nick Clegg has, which is a question of trust, doesn't it? Because I suppose the easy campaign, depending on how favourable you want to be towards Labour, is to say, look, you just can't trust Liberal Democrats to deliver on what they say they will. Look at tuition fees. I mean, how do the Liberal Democrats get over that? Or can they, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting sort of conundrum, because if you look at, you know, what Ed Miliband said earlier in this Parliament about how he was going to abolish tuition fees, and now he's talking about reducing tuition fees and reducing them in a way which actually helps well-off graduates rather than least well-off graduates, but reducing rather than abolishing. You know, he too has, in recent years, made a promise about tuition fees that he has then broken. And so something that I think probably causes a fair amount of frustration for a lot of Liberal Democrat activists is to think, well, why does that count against Labour? Against Liberal Democrats and not against Labour? And I think the answer is that And, you know, this is backed up again if you look at the polling and the way the party's ratings were declining well before the Brown Commission had reported in 2010 and so well before we knew what the Democrats were actually going to do on tuition fees in government, is that tuition fees has become the shorthand, convenient, you know, two-word summary of a wider, more complex set of views people have about the Liberal Democrats. And maybe even in hindsight, people are now thinking, oh, yes, it was tuition fees that made me go off the Liberal Democrats, when actually, if you track their views, oh, many of them went off the Liberal Democrats before tuition fees. So in a way, I think the answer is it's not tuition fees per se, but it's the fact that Liberal Democrats went into coalition government with another party that's the real issue.
Sure, and I think that it's fair to say that, you know, people are rarely single issue on how they vote, aren't they, when it, you know, even though they say they might be. Well, let's look a bit at some of the forecasting, because that's quite interesting. I mean, one of the things, when I used to work at Comres, one of the things that you would do just to get an indication of what a particular poll might be saying is sort of plug your figures into electoral calculus and make a prediction. And it was quite a useful way of using the uniform national swing to see what was what. But actually, I was doing that with a few of the kind of more recent VI polls. And it shows, you know, the Liberal Democrats on, you know, in some cases less than 10 seats. Now, that doesn't sound particularly likely to happen. A lot of the projections, again, using the very good May 2015 website to look at, you know, who sort of collect this information, show the Liberal Democrats anywhere between sort of 20 and 30 seats. I mean, what's your perception? That's still obviously almost half or more than half of where they are now. But you know, where do you see the Liberal Democrats ending up?
I think if you look at the range of different evidence that's out there, you can paint a plausible path to, you know, anywhere between a bit under 20 and a bit over 40. There is a massive range of outcomes that at this moment, you know, in mid-March, is quite plausible. The particular problem with, you know, uniform national swing is that overall, it's not bad as a way of getting a sense of how voting figures might turn into seats. And UNS has been reasonably accurate at elections for the two main parties. But the margin of error that you often get with UNS-based projections of sort of 10, 20 seats here or there, in 1983, 1987, 2001, 2005, doesn't really make a difference to the overall picture. You know one party is going to win by a huge margin.
Yep.
The problem is either when you're looking at the third party, or indeed fourth, fifth, etc. parties, or if you've got a really, really close election, actually that typical 10, 20 seats sort of margin of error becomes a massive issue, because that is the difference between being completely spot on and being way, way off. It's sort of the equivalent, I think, of the problem the pollsters face. You know, being within a couple of percent is, you know, you would normally think it's a pretty good result. But it may well be that a lot of pollsters get the party that has the most votes wrong, not because the figures are out by a lot, but because when it's so close, that sort of margin of error suddenly becomes the difference between calling the winner right and wrong.
Well, absolutely. I mean, if the election was literally tomorrow, then, you know, some pollsters have Labour ahead, some pollsters have the Conservatives ahead, don't they? Let's talk about Nick Clegg. Yeah, lots of attention on him, as you would expect, as a Deputy Prime Minister, but also on his potential to, you know, continue to lead the Liberal Democrats after this next election, but also actually whether he's going to be in Parliament at all. There's a lot of conflicting information about Nick Clegg's seat out there, isn't there? I mean, for example, I believe, I might be wrong, but I believe the last poll of his seat by Lord Ashcroft was pre-Christmas, although I might have that wrong. But it showed a sort of slight Labour lead, so certainly concern there amongst Liberal Democrats. At the same time, we had Matt Shaddick from Ladbrokes Politics on a couple of weeks ago now, I think it was, and he and Ladbrokes are actually quite bullish about Nick Clegg's chances of holding his seat. So I'm going to presume, as a Liberal Democrat, you're pretty confident.
You'll be shocked to know that I agree with Matt in this case.
I mean, what's behind that? I mean, presumably there, you know, it would be great for Labour to try and sort of unseat Nick Clegg, of course. Danny Alexander looks like he's in a lot of trouble in Scotland, and, you know, we haven't really touched on the Liberal Democrats in Scotland yet. So, I mean, what do you think the reasons are for Nick Clegg to be confident? Do you think it's a case of a storm in a teacup in terms of his prospects?
Well, I think it partly goes back to this whether or not you name the candidates question. And if actually maybe sort of start with the example of Danny Alexander, although there isn't a sort of a published Liberal Democrat constituency poll for Danny's seat, there is, as I mentioned earlier, one for the very nearby seat, Bob Smith in West Aberdeenshire. And that showed a big difference between naming the candidates and sort of Ashcroft poll approach of not naming the candidates. And if you assume that there's a similar uplift in other seats by naming the candidates, which is a reasonable, yeah, I think is a reasonable assumption to make, then that does make things like Danny Seat and Nick's seat look very, you know, very different. So without sort of spilling the beans, you know, on any of the sort of unpublished polling, I think when you look at the differences between naming and not naming the candidates in the polls that have been published, it's quite easy to see why, you know, lots of Liberal Democrats who have seen the party's internal polling, you know, do genuinely have a degree of confidence that as you say, might not be matched by Ashcroft not naming candidates polls from a little while ago.
But people are going to have a healthy degree of scepticism about the idea that there's a private poll sitting somewhere that has Danny Alexander, you know, very competitive in his seat that hasn't been published, when all the stuff that has been published has shown him really, really struggling. I mean, if he's not struggling as badly as, you know, some of these other polls say, why not publish it?
Well, there's a, you know, I think a whole set of, you know, pros and cons about releasing an internal poll in any particular constituency case. I think it's wise to be cautious about trying to read too much into why one particular poll might not have been published when other ones have been published. But I partly would go back to what I said before, is, you know, why would you think that a poll that doesn't name the candidates is a sensible way of doing polling? But also, I think it's important to bear in mind that in the two cases that we talked about, is they are both personalities that, you know, get considerable media coverage. So it's not like we're talking about not naming a candidate where in fact the incumbent is standing down and there's a new person who's only recently been selected, etc., where you might reasonably expect the incumbency effect to be smaller, but where you've got high profile incumbent MPs who have been MPs for a while. That's surely the very scenario when the name matters much more.
Mm. Okay. Well, let's assume, well, let's not worry too much whether Nick Clegg stays in or not, but let's assume the Liberal Democrats actually do relatively well. You know, they get, say, let's say 30 seats, for argument's sake. Yeah. That seems to be the top end of some of the projections at the moment. So that raises the question of potentially, actually, the Liberal Democrats almost halving their seats, but still being in a position to form a coalition, potentially, depending on how Labour or the Conservatives do. I've been talking with people on social media about this. There doesn't seem to be much agreement in terms of what's best for the Liberal Democrats next, in terms of what's... I mean, obviously, they want to win as many seats as possible, but then what's actually the ideal kind of then relationship with the government? What's your take on that? Because, you know, one of the things I often thought, and, you know, many people disagree with me, is that it would be quite good to be in a coalition with Labour next, because actually what that could then demonstrate is that we are not beholden to one party or the other. We will, you know, we have our own identity, and we'll do a deal with the Conservatives, we'll do a deal with Labour, and we'll have, over a period of, let's say 10 years, but however long it is, we'll have all these achievements that we can stand up and say we've achieved. But most people seem to disagree with me on that. So where do you stand? I mean, what's best for the Liberal Democrats after May?
Well, my colleague at work, Sean Kemp, who used to be one of Nick Clegg's special advisers, I think he's very good on the risks for the Liberal Democrats of being in coalition with Labour, because when the Liberal Democrats have been in coalition with the Tories, you know, the Lib Dems have been able to sort of be, as it were, the nice guys, you know, protect that bit of the welfare system, or we want to spend more money on that area of the public services, or we want to do this thing to protect our environment. In a Liberal Democrat Labour coalition, there would be an awful lot more of the Liberal Democrats being the ones to say, no, you can't spend money on this, no, you can't spend money on that, we've actually got to have fiscally responsible policies. Which I think would be probably even less popular than the impact of being in coalition with the Tories. So, you know, I think if the Liberal Democrats had a completely open choice as to who to go into coalition with, it would be a really hard choice. The reality, however, is almost certainly, you know, outside the realms of the Geoffrey Archer novel First Among Equals, the leader of the third party doesn't have a choice in that sense. Just as we saw in 2010, that... the maths didn't really...
The maths was only one way, wasn't it?
Yeah, so the maths will most likely only be one way. And also, it's up to Cameron and Miliband as well.
Sure. I mean, I have this personal sort of musing, I guess, that actually, you know, this new politics, as people call it, you know, will have its biggest scrutiny yet when we're faced with a situation where, you know, government is weak and divided and struggles to get things through. But perhaps one of the lesser discussed things is that in a minority government situation, a lot of these either Labour left-wing backbenchers or Conservative right backbenchers, you know, become even more important than they are now. And we've already seen from the Conservative side defections and things like that. I wonder whether something might happen with the Labour Party if they were in a similar situation where they have to promote austerity.
I mean, the other thing that will be really important, although it, you know, it's not so relevant in terms of electoral politics and opinion polls, but is the House of Lords. Because the basic way in which the House of Lords functions is, you know, it has huge amounts of power, but it doesn't exercise it to overturn something that the winner of an election put in their manifesto and said they would do. If, however, we have a minority government, why would the Lords sort of pull back from defeating anything? And obviously, in extremis, you can imagine the Lords pulling back from, you know, being so obstructive that in effect they make, you know, governing impossible, that crossbenchers, etc., would recoil from that. But on a massive range of legislation, where at the moment the Lords say, yes, okay, this was in the manifesto, fair enough, you know, we may argue a lot over amendments, but fundamentally it will go through, that won't apply. Or you could argue that it shouldn't apply if it's a minority government that, you know, didn't win and didn't put together a coalition that gives it, you know, gets it over the winning post in the Commons either. So I think we'll see the House of Lords kept extremely busy as well. And, you know, it may somewhat surprisingly revive, you know, not only questions of electoral reform, but even questions about an elected House of Lords, perhaps sooner rather than you might have expected given... Given the experience of this parliament.
Sure. I'm glad you brought up electoral reform. Andy White from Comres, who I'm not just plugging people I used to work with, I promise. You know, he's tweeted in a couple of points. One is about raising this very interesting point that the Liberal Democrats seemingly actually benefiting from the first-past-the-post. Seemingly benefiting from first-past-the-post. Certainly it looks like that they could get, you know, I don't know, argument's sake, 10% of the vote, but, you know, 30-odd seats, maybe. And UKIP could get more than that and far fewer. Do you think they'd still go, you know, full tilt for some sort of electoral reform? I mean, from an outsider, presumably they must. I mean, presumably that is one of these Liberal Democrat fundamentals that they want to
and pursue. I mean, there are 650 MPs in Parliament, so if the Liberal Democrats get, you know, let's say, take your scenario, 10% of the vote, actually under PR, the Liberal Democrats would have 65 MPs. So I think we can be almost certain that the party will come out with fewer MPs, even in this election, than it would have got under a PR system. So, you know, there is this, oh, isn't first past the post rescuing the Liberal Democrats? No, first past the post is so fundamentally unfair and broken as an electoral system that even in the current situation, the Liberal Democrats will do much worse under first past the post than they would under a, you know, a sort of sensible PR system. What will happen more generally in terms of electoral reform, I think, is, you know, it's local government in England and Wales that is quite likely to have electoral reform introduced, and that's certainly much more likely in the House of Commons, because there was the referendum on AV. Yes, it was a referendum on one particular, you know, form of electoral reform, but you have to respect the public made the decision, and I think it's very unlikely that there would be a successful sort of return to a referendum on House of Commons voting systems in the next Parliament. However, introducing STV for local government in England and Wales would bring England and Wales into line with what is already the case in Scotland, as well as the use of STV in Northern Ireland. I think that's important for a couple of reasons. One is, one of the reasons AV was defeated was a lot of scare stories. And those scare stories, you can't really work when we've got STV, you know, in place for a couple of rounds of local elections in Scotland now. You know, the idea that it's some weird foreign thing, if you're poking fun at Malta, you can maybe get away with. Just imagine the horrific damage either Labour or Tories would cause to themselves if they tried to argue, yeah, well, they have STV in Scotland, but by no means, you know, that's a weird foreign strange thing that couldn't possibly work in England. So it's a lot easier to do. It's also the fact, you know, the simple, crude politics of it. MPs voting for STV for local councils don't directly affect their own electoral prospects. Sure. And it's always easier to get people to change the rules that affect someone else rather than the rules that affect themselves.
Before we move on to finding of the week, briefly, I mean, because you have to go a few steps removed to get to here, but should Nick Clegg, I mean, okay, let's start at the beginning. Do you see Nick Clegg leading the Liberal Democrats in the next Parliament? And if not, you know, who are the sort of favourites to replace him? I mean, you know, we know what the bookies say, but what's your impression?
Well, I think the bookies are offering still very generous odds on the plausible non-Tim Farron candidates. I mean, Tim is the favourite, and I think he's right to be the favourite, but, you know, the value in betting is finding people or finding outcomes that are more likely than is implied by the odds.
Of course, yes.
And I would say probably Norman Lamb is the most plausible non-Tim Farron candidate. Possibly, if he decides to go for it, Alistair Carmichael, possibly Ed Davey, but I think of those three, Norman Lamb is the most plausible. And when I looked at the weekend, you could still get odds of 8-1 on Norman Lamb being the next Liberal Democrat leader when, you know, his actual chances are much, much higher than that. Tim Farron is certainly the favourite. One thing, though, that's worth bearing in mind, and this actually applies to all the parties, is if there is a hung parliament, it's really hard to do a deal with a party that doesn't have a leader.
Mm.
And this, in a way, is what the Liberal Democrats discovered in 2010, that the way, you know, having Gordon Brown stand down did, you know, make a logical sense in terms of him having lost the election and him being so unpopular. But the moment he went, the slim chance of a deal with Labour became completely non-existent. Because how do you do a deal with a party when you don't know who the leader's going to be? Because for any party, doing a deal is controversial. If you don't have a leader to provide the leadership through that controversy, and also if you don't know who the next leader is going to be and therefore what exactly their views are going to be, it's really hard to make a deal and make it stick. I think it will be tough enough for either Cameron or Miliband to make a deal anyway. But if you don't have leaders at both ends of the deal, that, again, I think becomes impossible. So for all of the party leaders, actually, I think their incumbency position in a hung parliament is initially at least a little bit stronger than you might expect.
That's interesting. Let's move on to finding of the week then. Regular listeners to the podcast will know this is when we kind of have our opportunity to talk about something else. What have you got? I mean, you've got a prediction game, is it?
Absolutely. At work at Blue Rubicon, we've launched a sort of fun little general election prediction game. We're sort of doing it partly for the charity that we support. So we're making a £5 donation to the Rainbow Trust for every entry. But also, whoever has submits the most, what turns out to be the most accurate prediction, other than obviously getting bragging rights for the next 5 years, will also donate £500 to a charity of their choosing. So if any listeners want to go to bluerubicon.com/thinking, that's bluerubicon.com/thinking, you'll find the Predict May the 7th competition there, an online form to fill in. Be great to get more predictions. Of the predictions that have come through so far, I've been pleasantly pleased to see how high the number of Liberal Democrat seats are in most of those predictions. That's not because it's just been me and Sean.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that a lot of Liberal Democrat predictions?
But actually, across a broad spread, I think there is a reasonable expectation that the Liberal Democrats will come out with a sizable number of MPs in the next election. And obviously, I hope these wise predictors will all turn out to be correct.
That was Polling Matters. A big thanks to my guest again, Mark Pack. Thank you for joining me, Mark. The music you're hearing is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under Creative Commons. Next week, we'll be talking Ed Miliband with Tim Bale. So join us for that one. But thanks again for listening and goodbye.